My biggest lesson learned, not only as a sort of an industry professional, but as a facilities manager, is that your issues are not unique to you. You didn't invent them. Whatever challenges you have, whether it's resources or staffing or system failures, are not unique to you. So don't be afraid to pick up the phone and reach out to a peer or a mentor or peer groups. Reach out to people that have experienced it before you. To work together to find a solution. I think all too often, especially facilities managers when they're young, will think, "Oh my God, this problem is unique to me. How am I going to solve it?" And they're racking their brains trying to think of all of their college learning and what did I learn in the books. And oftentimes, there's somebody who's dealt with it last week, last month, somebody you know. Just pick up the phone and call a friend.
This is Facility Rockstars, the podcast that celebrates the unsung heroes of our daily lives, facility professionals. I'm your host, Jay Culbert. Join me as we honor these great leaders, sharing stories, insights, and expertise that empower us all to learn and grow together. Facility Rockstars is sponsored by Colutus, operating the way you operate in order to make your life easier.
Welcome back to Facility Rockstars. I'm your host, Jay Culbert. I'm thrilled to introduce you to today's guest. He's a seasoned expert in developing market share through strategic relationships and innovative business development. He has worked in multiple fields such as project management, facilities management, construction coordination, information technology, architectural product design. He has excelled in various management and operations roles, specializing in areas such as architectural product design and custom furniture solutions. I'm excited to dive into his wealth of knowledge and insights today. He's the VP of Hub Office Installations, Ray Teberge. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jay. It always sounds better when somebody else says it. That's a great intro. I appreciate it. My mother's proud.
Oh, I'm glad you like it. I'm sure she'll like it. Great to have you here, man. Thanks
for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Happy to.
So we have a bunch of things we're going to run through today. And with your experience, it's going to be a great experience, I believe, for the audience to learn from what you've been through and what you've learned over the years.
Sure.
And that said, you know, I'm going to start with, what has been your biggest lesson learned over the years, Ray?
I think my biggest lesson learned, not only as a sort of an industry professional, but as a facilities manager, is that your issues are not unique to you. You know, you didn't invent them. Whatever challenges you have, whether it's resources or staffing or, you know, system failures, are not unique to you. So don't be afraid to pick up the phone and reach out to a peer or a mentor or, you know, peer groups. Reach out to people that have experienced it before you to work together to find a solution. I think all too often, especially facilities managers when they're young, will think, oh my God, this problem is unique to me. How am I going to solve it? And they're racking their brains trying to think of all of their college learning and what did I learn in the books? And oftentimes there's somebody who's dealt with it last week, last month, you know, somebody you know. Just pick up the phone and call a friend. Dial a friend, right? What was that TV show where you could have a lifeline?
Lifeline. Dial a
have
lifeline.
A lifeline. Dial a lifeline.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
Who wants to be a millionaire? Exactly. And I think that's my biggest lesson learned is these issues are not unique to you. The technology changes a little bit, but the issues are the same. You still need a mechanic with a screwdriver and a pair of pliers to fix something. No amount of AI is ever going to, you know, be able to change a fume hood by itself.
Sure.
Kind of thing. So I think that's my biggest lesson learned.
That resonates with me, Ray. It really does. Cause on the show, otherwise it doesn't matter really which industry we're speaking about. There's the same set of challenges that most people face, right?
Yeah. Lack of resources, right? Whether it be your annual budget or, you know, upper management, not giving the resources that you need, which could be cash, could be CapEx, could be manpower, lack of communication, lack of planning. You know, like you said, it doesn't matter what the industry is or whether you're talking mechanical or plumbing or electrical or space planning or moves or technology, you're all struggling with the same things.
Very true. You touched on reaching out or, you know, let's say use a lifeline, right? Like we joked about there, but kidding aside, you know, if someone's newer in their career, or even if they're not that comfortable picking up a phone and asking for help, what advice would you give? How would you encourage those people to just do it or find a way to reach out?
Yeah, I would say first step is admission, right? Recognition. Mm-hmm. Recognize that we are each our own greatest obstacle. So get mm-hmm. past that, you know, be patient with yourself. And I think it's part of your career development is to develop a network of peers and potentially mentors. Everybody should have at least one, if not multiple mentors. And, you know, I've been blessed to have multiple over my lifetime. Some of them have passed, but, you know, regardless, over time, and whether I think it's through professional networking, through groups like IFMA, BOMA, CRU, you know, other professional networking groups, that you find not only other peers that you can lean on to say, hey, you know, we used to work together, or you're in a similar industry, you know, who is your favorite, you know, HVAC contractor, or, you know, who's your favorite life safety contractor, whatever. Or just developing senior managers that you liked working with that maybe have gone on to another company and they're not a competitor anymore. You're not in that worker, manager, employee relationship anymore, but you can still lean on them as a mentor to say, I'm struggling with the subordinate, or I'm struggling with a subcontractor. You know, how do you recommend I handle this? That sort of thing.
Great advice. Great advice. And you mentioned networking groups. We're going to get back to that. We're going to dig into that actually. But you also mentioned lack of resources. I did want to touch on that. It's not something we've really talked too much about, you and I, in the past. But can you talk about resources and how to? So if there is a lack, or if there's a struggle, what's a best practice that you've seen or implemented over the years to secure those resources or to make them more available?
Well, you know, I think the classic expression is knowledge is power, and data is the tool. So if you're not keeping track of it, then you're not managing it. So you know that something's a problem because you can feel the pain as a facilities manager, right? This issue keeps cropping up. I keep getting complaints about air temperature. I keep getting complaints about the bathrooms not being clean, or, you know, whatever. The phone system's not working. And it's not enough to just have anecdotal evidence. You as a facilities manager need to get better at tracking the data, actually logging it. How often does the phone system go down? Actually, how many air temperature control tickets do I get in a week, in a month, in a year? Now you start to collect some data. Now you've got something to lean on to make a request, whether it's, you know, part of your annual budget or a CapEx request, to say, hey, I need 100,000 for this. I need $500,000 for this. We need to upgrade this. You're not just doing it anecdotally. You're basing it on actual data from your customers. And your customers are the corporation's customers. And if we can work together with senior management, then we can get more productivity. Our end users are spending less time complaining about their work environment, or less time processing tickets or asking for requests. They can just focus on what they're supposed to be doing, because we're creating a productive, healthy, safe work environment for them. But it's got to be based on data. So you as a facilities manager, first off, need to collect the data, whether it's frequency or severity, whatever it is, you got to collect that data first and then use that to get the resources that you need. You just have to be patient, because it doesn't come quick, right? You're not going to walk into a VP's office and say, hey, by the way, I need $500,000 for a new roof air handler. That's not going to happen. You need some data. And so you need to find a way to manage the end user's expectation and say, look, I hear you. I hear you that this isn't good for you, that it's too cold, or, you know, whatever, or the bathrooms aren't clean, you know, whatever that issue is. Let them know that you're working on it, but that you are collecting the data. You got to have a trend, and then you can make the CapEx requests.
You mentioned the great advice. This is, it's critical, and it's come up quite a bit, in my career anyway, and tracking that data and actually keeping track of it, right? So what is the best way to do so in your experience, Ray? Like, is it a better CMMS? Is it what's the best way to actually do that for a facility manager?
Yeah, I think that's on a personal basis. You know, CMS is a great place to start. Maybe you're old fashioned and it's just in a spreadsheet, you know, and that's fine, because a lot of times you can do better graphing and show it visually, you know, through a spreadsheet. But CMMS, I think, is the raw data, you know, to track customer requests about issues that they have. that'll give you the raw data. But I think ultimately I'm a spreadsheet guy and I need to do a pie chart or a bar chart or something to show trending over time.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure. I want to jump back to, you mentioned IFMA and BOMA, a few other organizations.
Sure.
I know you have experience very closely with IFMA, but before we really get to that, it's what have you seen in terms of changes with these types of networking groups over your 40 years in the industry?
Sure. I think the changes that I've seen are that the groups are more focused on, I don't know if socialization is the right word, but building networks, because they know it's healthy for their membership as well. Mm-hmm. So something like a CoreNet, you know, or IFMA or BOMA, it's all about membership, right? If you don't have that critical mass of membership, then you're not really a viable chapter, mm-hmm. if that's the right word. Mm-hmm. And so more of the programming, more of the servicing that they're offering is about networking. You have more social hours, you know, building tours, that sort of thing. Professional development is still part of it. I just have seen professional development almost take a back seat to network development. So if you go back to the 80s and 90s, it was about developing the profession of facilities management, getting certified, being a CFM, you know, that sort of thing. Being a certified building property manager. And now in the last 20 years, as they've seen membership drop off, it's been more about networking and doing events where people want to come together, whether it's a golf tournament or a building tour or some interesting speaker with beverages and a little reception and getting more people together because they recognize that being a facilities manager is as much about your network as it is about your technical prowess.
Hmm. So did that leave any void for the professional development side of it though? Or where are people finding that these days? Could you shed any light?
I think there's a big question mark there. You know, we saw an uptick in the late 90s and early 2000s in higher ed, you know, actually getting degrees in facilities management. And unfortunately, in the last 5 years, we've seen a retreat of that, that amongst the millennials and younger audience, there seems to be less of an interest in getting your hands dirty. You know, I think facilities management is still viewed by the 20-somethings as a getting your hands dirty kind of profession. And they want to work from home. You know, they're not interested in being tied to a building 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm. So the demand for facilities management degrees has really diminished. So I've seen higher ed sort of get out of that business. You know, I know Wentworth now offers it, I think, as a minor. They offer some classes in it. And really, I think Mass Maritime is kind of the only place to get a facilities management degree. And Mass Maritime's definition of facilities management is, I think, a little different. Their facilities management is more maritime, you know, facilities and boiler plants kinds of facilities. A little bit different than a corporate high-rise tower. So, you know, I've seen that shift. And so it's left a void. You know, I think groups like IFMA have done a pretty good job of offering professional development classes. I think they could promote it more. I think we could get more participation in the professional development. I think that's where the big question mark is right now, is if higher ed has moved away from it and the professional development groups have moved kind of sideways on it, you know, where do you turn to get stronger in that skill set?
You know, I love this topic. A couple more questions, Ray. You know, you're in a leadership position in IFMA, or you lead one of the chapters, is it? I should remember this clearly.
That's all good. I'm on the board of directors for the Boston chapter. Okay. I'm a vice president, and I was the vice president of special events. And now, I think July 1st, I am the vice president of membership. So I'm working with the committee on helping to drive membership to the Boston chapter of IFMA.
Now, excellent stuff. You mentioned IFMA could potentially promote the professional development side of things more. And if there are resources, I'm sure, like for our listeners today, what would you recommend? How would they tap into those resources?
Sure. Well, obviously, you have to become a member of the chapter in order to benefit from that. But we have a whole subcommittee on professional development, and we have some excellent trainers and some excellent material. I think the obstacles are people have to be aware of it. And I think that we as a chapter could do a better job of marketing those resources and making people aware that if you'd like to become a certified facilities manager, or there are many different gradations of that as well, then we have those resources available. But I think the other big challenge, Jay, is people feel reluctant to commit the time, that they either don't have the time or they're reluctant to commit the time, because it's almost kind of like night school, right? You're working so hard all day, you know, treading the wheel, and then to take classes that challenge your brain at night to learn and understand the material better, to be able to take the certification exam, I think people are a little more reluctant to. So I think those are the obstacles.
I think
we need to do a better job of promoting and marketing it. But I also think that there's a trend that people are reluctant to go that extra mile and give up their spare time.
With these events and given your role with IFMA, what would you say is the biggest takeaway for people when they do choose to invest the time, and maybe not just on the professional development, but on a global perspective? They're going to go to an event, say, once a month or whatever cadence it might be. Mm-hmm. What are they looking to achieve there? Building their network, clearly we talked about. But what else do you, you know, when you go home and you say, wow, I'm really glad I went to that event. What's the why behind that, Ray?
I think to some degree, personal satisfaction, right? Mm-hmm. We all want to be proud of the work that we do. But when you do it in a vacuum, it leaves a void, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing it by myself. There's nobody who really understands my job. And that's not healthy. So right. To get together with peers who do understand your job, who do understand the same challenges that you're in now, maybe they might be the facilities manager of a biotech and you run an insurance company, but you're going to find out it's all the same issues. You know, maybe you have to deal with mice in a lab and they have to deal with, you know, cash flow and embezzling and people running out the back door with bags of cash. I don't know, you know, whatever the issues are. It's still facilities management. So by getting together with peers, you get that joint camaraderie of understanding the challenges that you each face. So yeah, you get the network as well. So you can share some ideas. And then I think you get a little bit more job satisfaction out of you. So, okay, I feel a little bit better equipped to face the challenges of tomorrow because I met two or three new people today.
Sure.
And maybe there might be subcontractors that just deal, you know, I met a new electrician that I really like, and I think he gets me and he gets my priorities and what I'm trying to do. I think I might involve him. Or I met a new facilities manager from Liberty Mutual or Blue Cross Blue Shield or Bay Banks or Verizon or Fidelity or what have you. And I think that I can lean on them if I have a problem. So it gives you that sense of confidence, I think, is some of the takeaways.
That's outstanding. Yeah. Excellent. So again, given your experience, we talked about the change in professional development, the desire or lack of desire and the void there. What about the facilities management role in and of itself? What you know, changes have you seen? What evolution have you seen in this role over the years, Ray?
Sure. No, that's awesome. If I think back to, again, the 80s and 90s, the role of the facilities manager, I think, was much more technical. You know, when you were working towards getting your certification, whether it was a degree or actual IFMA certified facilities manager certification, it was about, CFMs in your HVAC system and understanding, you know, head pressure of plumbing systems. It was much more technical. I don't want to say hands-on, but it was more engineering. You had to be able to have a basic competency of engineering across the board, electrical engineering, plumbing engineering, HVAC. You didn't become an HVAC engineer, but you had to have a basic competency in those areas. And that was really the focus. That the focus was, in order for you to be able to manage a building or a campus of buildings, mm-hmm. it's almost like you had to be an engineer in each of those disciplines, which was pretty broad.
Sure.
And then I think what I've seen over the last 20 years, now that we've come into the 21st, is that the focus is more on people management rather than systems management. That as a facilities manager, you don't have to carry the screwdriver and the pliers. You don't have to fix anything. You just have to know how to manage the people. Now, by people, I mean internally, because some facilities managers are one-person islands. Man or woman, doesn't matter. But other facilities departments are 15 technicians on staff and 27 different subcontractors that we deal with. And mm-hmm. the facilities manager really needs to manage those resources, manage the budgeting, manage the billing, managing the ticket requests and resolution, make sure they're resolved to their satisfaction, make sure all parties are communicated with. So that's the evolution that I've seen. The facilities managers have become revolved more into people resource managers than technical engineers.
That definitely resonates. One of the most common conversations we've had is around teams and team development and teamwork and collaboration. So that's very prevalent. Very, very prevalent.
It's refreshing when you have a client, you know, because I'm acting in a sub role. And so you meet with a client who really understands what you do, you know, technically, and they're really, you know, technically adverse, you know, to what you're doing. But their people skills are terrible. Mm. And so then you mobilize, you engage. Okay, I go to 125 High Street and I'm going to, let's say for me, a classic would be like I'm decommissioning the 17th floor. Mm-hmm. And so I've been contracted to go into the 17th floor and clean out the 17th floor because they're giving the lease back to the landlord. And the lease document says you must leave the space broom swept. And I get there and there's still hampers and hampers full of personal belongings. There's still three people sitting in their workstations with their computers pretending mm-hmm. to be working. Mm-hmm. And I start tearing things apart. And they're like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, well, what are you doing here? Oh, well, nobody told me I couldn't be working. I'm like, we've been negotiating this for 6 months. Like, didn't you get an email or a memo that says you have to be moved off the floor? No, I didn't. So it's that sort of lack of communication and lack of personal touch that I think leaves the big disconnects.
You could not have segued better in the question, Ray. So kind of lead up. There were two different routes we'll go. We'll go this route first. Communication, right? And to be more succinct, like you just classified yourself as more of a sub role. Agreed, we are as well. Given that, when any sub goes in or any kind of disruption happens, how do you minimize downtime? How do you minimize friction? But I want to back that up first to the communication aspect. So when that does occur and you go into the 17th floor and three people are still working, how do we resolve? So what's the best practice to get ahead of that and avoid it in the future? What have you, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think there's two parts of that question to put some words in your mouth, Jay. It's sure. How do you avoid it and how do you react to it? Because here you are, you know, I get 10 union carpenters behind me. They all want to work. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, whoa, wait, let me go over and talk to them. You know, hi, my name's Ray. You know, it's my understanding that you were supposed to be moved to another floor before we got here. So obviously the first thing I do is I'm picking up the phone. I'm not sending an email. I'm not sending a text. I'm picking up the phone and I'm calling the facilities manager. Say, hey, Joe, I'm here on the 17th floor. Today's, you know, October 17th at 6 a.m., just like you contracted me to do. And I'm here with a crew and trucks and equipment. And we're ready to start tearing things down. And there's three employees here. What do you want me to do? I can stand down. I can demobilize or I can move forward. Your call. Mm-hmm. And then give them the chance to manage it because it's their property. You know, they're their employees and I have to give them the opportunity to manage it. I don't pretend to be in their role and to have any stake in that, if you will. I know who my customer is. It's the facilities manager. Mm-hmm. And I want to be a resource to them and I don't want to cause more headaches and more problems. You know, I want that employee who's sitting in the cube to be able to call the facilities manager when the facilities manager calls them and says, yeah, what are you doing on the 17th floor? Oh, yeah, I met Ray. Very nice. You know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I want it to be a positive experience mm-hmm. rather than contentious. Mm-hmm. So you just really deal with it with communication, going right to the heart. Nothing worse. I hate sending emails and having a project manager go, well, I sent them an email, you know, 3 days ago, but I haven't heard anything. Well, you just pick up the phone and call them.
So, Ray, clearly when we call that facility manager the day that three people are still working, that just their elevated stress levels, right? That day became much more challenging for them. So, like we said, too, how do we get ahead of that? Like you've seen so many successful projects in your career. Right. So I believe as a vendor or sub, you know, it's our responsibility to set them up for success, of course, as well as ours, because our success will be theirs. So how have you seen that to be most effective? What, in your experience, how do you get ahead of that phone call when three people are still on a floor that should be empty?
Yeah, I think in two ways. One is to physically walk the floor with them, because there's always some little nuggets, some little jewels here or there, whether it's a base feed that hasn't been disconnected, a coil of networking cable that's sitting on the floor, what have you, a Cisco router, you know, electrical equipment hanging out of the ceiling that nobody had accounted for, and that's all going to be removed. But also sitting down and having a face-to-face meeting with the facilities manager, going over the floor plan and saying, okay, making notes. You know, I think we should start early. I think we should do this on the weekend, whatever. How many days do you want to allocate to this? I mean, I can do it over 2 weeks. I can do it over 2 days. What works for you? Sure. I'm just going to adjust my manpower based on how many days you give me, that sort of thing. But then you're also sharing the experience. I think that's the hard part, Jay, because you want to share your experience without being a, hey, you know, this disaster happened at this company and this disaster, and just be telling disasters. You want to sort of be a mentor yourself, because obviously at my age, a lot of my customers are younger than I am. And so you want to, I don't want to say be a mentor, but at least share and say, hey, have you considered this? Make sure you get the communication out in time. Make sure you double check with the dock master. You know, nothing's worse than I have 10 union guys and 4 trucks at a dock and we can't get in because the tenant has spoken to the property manager, but the property manager hasn't spoken to the dock master or security. And we're not on the approved list. And it's 6 a.m. and who's going to give us authority to get in? So unless you want me to call you, the facilities manager, at 6 a.m, please make sure you double check that all of these obstacles are going to be out of the way. And so that's sort of my approach, is as long as the facilities manager is looking out for me and identifying what are the obstacles that are going to prevent me from doing my work to their best advantage, now I'm looking out for them and their best interest.
Fantastic. It sounds like very good pre-project planning too. Very good. A lot of clarity in that. We're talking about, and let's stay with this for a minute, Ray, because I think it's important to, like, that was an empty floor. And that's like the example you gave, right? This floor needs to be cleared out and emptied.
Right.
How about a floor where we've talked in the past where, you know, a glass wall system just needs to be reconfigured and, you know, you want to minimize, again, I'm going to say minimize disruption or any downtime at all to our clients' operations. How do you, is there any difference in how you plan for occupied space moves versus an empty floor?
Yeah, those are the hardest ones, the occupied spaces. I mean, I think the first approach is you got to do it overtime. You got to do it in the evening or on the weekends. You know, Saturdays are usually quite productive. People, I think, used to work later. So even getting into some spaces at 6 at night, you know, was a problem. But now getting into space at 5:30, 6 o'clock is not a problem. There usually isn't anybody around, or maybe one or two. And the facilities manager sent out an email, hey, by the way, hub will be in at 6 o'clock to, you know, start knocking these stations down or knock this conference room down and reconvert it. I think the biggest challenge for that planning situation, Jay, is that human resources has maybe been interviewing some new hires, you know, on the customer service team. And they have 3 people starting on Monday. And human resources says, oh, we've done our due diligence. We've interviewed this person, these 3 people, you know, the 27 candidates. We whittled it down to 3. We've done all the background checks. They've interviewed with 14 people in the company. We finally selected these 3. We gave them the offer letter. They accepted, you know, they go through all of their process. And then they're like, yeah, we're good. We have 3 candidates, 3 new people start with the company. They start Monday. And they don't make that. Oh, wait, has anybody told facilities that they're starting on Monday? Oh, and then we get the call literally on Friday. Hey, Ray, we have 3 new employees starting on Monday and they have no place to sit. Can you come in and subdivide a conference room for the 2 VPs? And we need a workstation overnight, you know, in this area. Now it's occupied space. You're like, okay, I can do that. But has anybody moved all the photocopiers out of the way, all the boxes of paper, the 17 pairs of shoes? You know, I'm going to find 6 purses in this conference room in the credenza. You know, there's rewiring that needs to be done. It just impacts so many people. And so trying to do it last minute, it isn't so much the occupied space thing. It's the last minute. So there's the 5 P's, pathetically poor planning causes, you know, poor performance.
Sure.
Or you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
There's some words in there that I can't say even on a podcast, but you know what I mean? Proper planning prevents a pathetically poor performance, I think is the phrase. So
maybe that's the answer, right? I guess it's a communication and proper planning, because, you know, that's when it goes sideways. So, but we end with your experience. So is the best practice, if you will, you as the mentor, as you said, or the coach to the program or the process, do you notify HR and do you ask HR and facilities these questions well ahead? Or how do you solve for that?
I know where I am. I'm downhill, right? I'm down the chain, so I can't talk to HR. So I think the answer is that facilities needs to realize that they have their own internal customers, let's say the end users.
Sure.
But they also have internal customers like HR, and they need to have a relationship with HR. It isn't adversarial. And if you want those disconnects, then just have a disconnected relationship with them. But if you want them to understand how their decisions and their actions impact you, then you need to have that conversation. The facilities manager needs to educate and have a relationship with HR to understand that their decisions impact them. And even if it's just a heads up to say, hey, we think we're going to hire 3 people next month for the customer service team. Okay, then as facilities manager, you can get ahead of it, you know, and be prepared so that when they pull the trigger, you're already locked and loaded. You got everybody lined up. It's just a matter of picking a date and go with it. But it's when HR dumps something on you last minute that you set yourself up for failure. You set your own internal team up for failure because there's no way you can respond that fast. You can respond that fast, but there's no way you can respond that fast successfully without something being disconnected, without somebody being upset, because you haven't had the chance to communicate it to everybody. That's the other half, proper planning and communication. Have you communicated it to all of the stakeholders? Have you communicated it to all of the occupants? Facilities managers, it doesn't matter how justified you are. You're like, oh, HR just dumped this on me. I have to build 3 stations this weekend. And they're justified in their mind why it has to happen. I agree with the justification, but even with the justification, have you communicated it? So that it's not, you know how it was a surprise to you when HR called you and said, we got 3 people starting Monday? Well, it's a surprise to the end user when they come in on Saturday to try to get some quiet time work done, and Ray's in there with 10 guys with drills and saws and things are flying all over the place. And they're like, hey, I came in for quiet work. What are you guys doing here? Oh, didn't anybody communicate to you? No, they didn't. So that's the second part of what makes it successful is proper communication.
Excellent. Excellent advice. Excellent, Ray. I have one more question for you.
Sure.
We are learning a lot. Fred, don't say anything. You don't know what I might throw at you. Careful. Watch out. No.
We have an editor, right?
We're learning a ton from you. I want to learn a little bit more here and then learn a little bit more about you, right?
Sure.
How'd you get to where you are today? But before that, safety. That's really the topic, right? So safety.
I love it.
Is paramount with
any
organization, or at least should be if it's not. So how do you set your organization up to align with or exceed the programs of the companies and customers they're walking into to serve?
Sure. So I totally agree with you about safety. If your employees are going home injured or can't work, then the whole process doesn't work. You know, it's about sending them home at the end of the day in at least as good a shape, if not better than they were when they came in, you know, hopefully happy and a little more satisfied about their job satisfaction. But in terms of physical injuries, and I think that bodes to emotional as well. You know, there are definitely work situations, certainly in construction, where it can get to be pretty tense. But let's just talk about physical safety.
Sure.
And so for me, it depends on how long the job is. If I'm going to be, you know, let's say at Liberty Mutual for 6 weeks with a crew of guys because we're building out a floor. Liberty Mutual's taking the 12th floor in this tower, and the GC just got done doing the sheetrock and carpet. Space is completely empty. Now I come in and I build it out to be Liberty Mutual, right? Based on their standards and the design, blah, blah, blah. Products get shipped into us from all over the world. We aggregate them, prep them, and get out there and do our thing. If we're going to be there for 6 weeks, then I'm going to bring my foreman in and we're going to meet with the facilities manager or his designee, typically a project manager, or sometimes the property manager may have their own safety standards. And we're going to talk about how we're going to access the building, dock access, elevator access, how we're going to work on the floor, what bathrooms we can use, you know, safety requirements about where we can cut, you know, clean up, PPE requirements. Is the GC going to be on site or not? You know, that sort of thing. So I typically have 3 parties that I'm trying to please, not only my own internal processes and procedures about safety, but if the GC's there, I have to respect his safety policies because he still owns the site unless the GC's turned it over to the end user, in this case of this scenario, Liberty Mutual. And then maybe like Oxford Properties or something, or WS Development owns the building. And then I have to check with them, what are your requirements? So my point is, I get the foreman, because they're really the gatekeeper for safety. They're the eyes and ears of safety for us as an employer. I get their head wrapped around what are the requirements. Mm-hmm. If they're only going to be there for, let's say, a week or two, then we're going to have an internal meeting, our own project manager, myself, and we'll meet at the office to go over the drawings. And I'll say, okay, this is what we expect, not only in terms of productivity and scheduling, but in terms of safety. For me, the greatest tool for safety is a JHA, job hazard analysis. Mm-hmm. I love it. You know, they can get to be boring and a little tedious, but I love it because it forces the foreman, and I like to do them on a daily basis every morning. Foreman, you get there a half hour early. I'll pay you. Get there a half hour early. Think about what the workflow is today. What are you going to build? How are you going to build it? How are you going to cut? How are you going to assemble it? How are you going to bring products in and store it and strip it? And how are you going to deal with the trash? How are you going to get the trash out? All of those things are opportunities for somebody to get hurt. The JHA forces the foreman to sit down and think about each of those individual processes and what he or she can do to ensure the safety of their team members. And so I like a JHA every single day. So we include that as part of our daily process. And then at the end of the day, we have a tool called the DPR Daily Progress Report, where they include pictures and some notes about what did we get done today and what are my goals for tomorrow and the rest of the week. So I think for me, the two together, the job hazard analysis every morning really starts their mindset off right, because they've drilled down. It's not just, hey, guys, we're here again. Let's just keep doing what we did yesterday. There's always something that's different, whether it's extension cords or ladders or scaffolding or Baker staging, that needs a little extra attention, and the JHA each day forces them to do that.
Outstanding. Ray, it sounds like you have a fantastic process and extremely thorough and consistent, right? It's consistent.
That's it. Just consistency. You
know, right.
Then it isn't work anymore. It's just mm-hmm. part of the process. Yep.
Excellent. All right. Now we have to learn a little bit about you, Ray. So, all right. I'm going to throw this at you. So what would today's Ray give the 20-year-old Ray for advice? What advice would you give yourself, the 20-year-old self?
I would say have a vision, have a goal, and just stick to that track. You know, I think part of what makes me valuable today, so this is the antithesis of that, you know, life coaching. Part of what makes me valuable today is that I've worn so many hats. I've done so many different things within this interior specialties, facilities management industry, all the way from, you know, like in the introduction, from new business development to product design, to mm-hmm. information technology, to demountables, to teaching. I taught at Wentworth for a while. I loved teaching. It was great. Awesome. But I think that I would have gotten to this point faster if I had just stayed on track. You know, I think if I had just become a certified facilities manager and become a facilities manager, you know, I think I would have gotten there faster. But I don't know that's the right thing for me. You know, I think I liked the diversity of my experiences. Mm-hmm. I really relish them. And I think it's part of what makes me who I am. But I think I would have avoided a lot of the bumps and bruises along the way. Of banging up, sort of like tacking in sailing, right? When you learn sailing.
Yes.
You can be in a speedboat and just go straight ahead at 60 miles an hour, or you can be a sailboat and tack. And I'd like to think that my career has been a little bit of both.
So, I'll tell you, although I'm not huge on sailing, Ray, I love that analogy. Because it's like, look, if you don't tack left and tack right, how are you going to see what's over there?
Right.
If you're just... straightforward the whole time, you might miss a whole tunnel on the way. So
you do. You miss learning where the shores are and seeing the shore.
Yep.
And I think going through that experience of, oh my God, my sail's out of control. I'm hooking left and I want to be going straight. How do you, you know, fix that again? And then by the end of that journey, you're really good at the ropes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Arms are a little stronger too.
Exactly.
So what else about you, Ray? You notice I didn't realize that you taught at Wentworth. That's fantastic. You know, I think we all learn from teaching, but you did it formally. So
absolutely. So my undergrad is in architectural engineering from Wentworth. which I thoroughly enjoyed. I think of myself as right brain and left brain, and that's what I liked about that, that I learned the aesthetic design side and the importance of that, but I also learned the engineering of all of the systems, electrical, mechanical, structural, behind what it takes to build a building. And therefore, I think it made me better equipped to be a facilities manager, you know, because in all of my jobs that I've ever had, I've also been the facilities manager. You know, I've done these other things, but also I was responsible for managing the facilities. So I could relate to my customers, the facilities manager, because I was that in my own corporation. So that was cool. But then when I graduated Wentworth, I actually went up to New Hampshire and I worked for an architectural firm up in Campton, New Hampshire, and did a lot of custom homes and ski lodges and sports facilities and that sort of thing up in the Waterloo Valley area, and really got a good sense of that profession and sharpened my CAD skills. That was really my specialty, was computer-aided design. I mean, we're talking 1987, mm-hmm. AutoCAD version one kind of thing.
Yep.
And then I got the opportunity, actually Wentworth called me. A buddy of mine was teaching AutoCAD at Wentworth, and he was going to go off and start his own construction company, and he recommended that they hire me as faculty. And so I took the opportunity, came back and taught full-time for about 2.5 years, and then I taught part-time for another six nights and weekends. Thoroughly loved it. Just couldn't really make a living at it enough to raise a family on. Mm-hmm. I was at that point in my life where I was getting married and starting to have kids. So I got an offer to actually, in night school, I was teaching an AutoCAD class. And at the end of the final exam, three young ladies that were interior designers at a contract office furniture firm called Osborne Office Furniture came up to me afterwards. And I said, is there a problem? You handed in your exams. Like, why are you still here? And they're like, we would like you to come be our boss. Mm. Our manager, the design manager, had just moved on. And I was like, wow, that's really flattering. It happened. I knew a mutual friend that worked there. And so it got me back into contract office furniture. So I did that for almost about 20 years, 17, 18 years. I was on the dealer side and felt that I had maxed out, got into product development, project management, demountables. And then I flipped to the labor side. I worked non-union for a little while. And then I was at another union installer for about 10 years, built them up. And now I'm at Hub doing a similar role, helping them grow and become more diverse and offer a deeper set of services to the facilities management and contract office furniture communities.
What a great journey, Ray.
It's been great.
Walking us through that. And what a nice compliment those three people gave you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
A nice surprise and a great compliment.
You are. Yeah, it was.
Nice. Any hobbies outside of work? Any time?
You know, I'm a very outdoorsy guy. I'm originally born and raised in Lewiston, Maine. So I learned to be outdoorsy then. And for me, it keeps me grounded. I really love unplugging, disconnecting. I'm a huge fan of the White Mountains National Forest. So I'm up there year round, 12 months a year, you know, backpacking, mountain climbing, camping. I love go 10, 15, 20 miles deep. Cell phone towers can't reach you anymore. Oh, sorry, my cell phone doesn't work. No tears here. Shut it off and pack it away and just enjoy the wilderness and get back to grounded, you know, being with the wilderness and with nature, remind you about what's important. My TikTok feed is not what's important.
Right.
You know, being able to appreciate the blessings that we have around us is what's important. So that's good. My wife and I are also heavily involved in scouting, actually. And we take a lot of kids into the White Mountains. We took 23 kids last year to Iceland for a week.
Wow.
I've been a half dozen times, totally love Iceland, and it was really cool. You just knew that for those kids, it was a life-changing experience, that they would never forget that, you know, scuba diving in glacial waters, climbing a glacier the next day, climbing a volcano the next day, going horseback riding, just seeing the terrain is surreal. The food's fabulous, by the way, was really cool. So those are my hobbies, being outdoors and helping kids grow through scouting and learn leadership skills and that sort of thing.
Outstanding. Wow. Very diverse. Good.
I try.
That's great. So if people wanted to learn more about, I guess, anything from scouting to IFMA to Hub Office or just facility management best practices, how would they get in touch with you, Ray? What would you recommend?
I would recommend my personal email is Ray, R-A-Y, really easy, at Flaxin, F-L-A-X-I-N.com. It's a domain. It's a name that I made up 30, 40 years ago, and it's just unique, and I registered it, so I'll have it for the rest of my life. It's kind of cool. And then my mobile phone, I'm happy for anybody to give me a ring, is 857-891-3107. And I'd be more than happy to talk to anybody about any of the topics that we talked about today. I love getting to know new people and share ideas. It goes both ways, but it starts with connecting.
Totally agree. Ray, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate you investing your time with us today.
Truly my pleasure, Jay. Thank you. I'm so glad that you reached out.
Of course. And thank you to our listeners, the audience. If you heard something you liked, if you learned something, tell somebody else about the show. And that's another great episode of Facility Rockstars all wrapped up. We'll see everyone next time.
It's a wrap. Another episode of Facility Rockstars is in the books. Facility Rockstars is sponsored by Kaludis, operating the way you operate in order to make your life easier. Until next time, facilitate and rock on.